Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome. How's everyone doing?
Great.
Great. Glad to hear it.
Excuse me.
The title of my talk today is Continuous Practice. Continuous Practice. Kind of a scary phrase, isn't it? I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, I don't want to practice continuously. I like to practice. I'm committed to practice. But practice is hard. You might think, well, I'll make myself a deal. I'll come to early morning meditation, and I will practice continuously all morning, but afternoon comes, and I'm going to relax. And I'm going out with friends tonight. We're going to the bar, and I'm not going to practice, okay? I'm not going to be following my breath. So I'm going to indulge my brain. I'm going to let it entertain me. I'm going to have fun. No continuous practice. I'm not making fun of anyone. We all have these kinds of thoughts. So since I'm going to talk about practice this morning, I'd like to first define what I mean by that. And I'm going to use a couple of phrases from Francis Cook from his introduction to a book of translations of Dogen, which is called How to Raise an Ox. And he says, "It is our human nature to pick and choose, to desire and loathe, to form myriad attitudes and judgments toward the events of our lives." So, picking and choosing. Practice is simply not doing that. Not picking and choosing. This practice is difficult, he says, because it demands of us that we simply cease the picking and choosing, desiring and loathing. And he also says, non-practice means continuing to approach every situation with self-centered attitude. So I'm using practice in this wider sense. Practice often takes the form of doing zazen or engaging in ritual or doing walking meditation or doing mindful work. But practice is not limited to that. Practice occurs really any time that you can find a way to give up your self-centered view and simply be present with the situation in a really open way, letting it be what it is. So it can happen any time during your day. And it usually takes some effort. So, continuous practice. When I first heard that phrase, I found it a little disturbing. On the one hand, it's a real ideal. It's a real ideal. Yeah, that's what I want. I really care about the Buddhist path. I know that this is the best way to live, and I want to do it well for the sake of all beings. And I want to be the best Buddhist I can. Continuous practice. That's my ideal. On the other hand, when I started this practice, that was so far from the reality, you know. I'm not sure when I first heard this phrase, but I think it was probably when I first started my formal practice, which was in Ann Arbor in 1990. I was going to law school then, and I was attending the Ann Arbor Zen Temple, a Korean Zen temple. And I'd been practicing on my own for a long time using books. I'd been meditating on my own, and that was great. But now I was beginning my practice with others, and so I was challenged by a lot. I had to give up my own idea of what my practice should be and kind of follow the ways of practice as it was being taught to me. And being new to the practice, I made a special effort at Zen Temple, and I felt very alive there. They burned a lot of incense there. And to this day, when I smell incense, when I get a little whiff of incense here, and we don't use it very much because some people are sensitive to it, but when I get that little whiff of incense, it takes me back to that temple, and it takes me back to the great effort I made there. And it's like, yeah, I'm home. I'm still home. I went to that temple, and I thought, wow, I have arrived at home after all these years. You know, I'm still there. So I would also meditate at home, and I had a very dedicated meditation practice, 5 minutes a day, every day. And it was good. It was transforming. And on Wednesday nights, I would go to the Zen temple, and I would do 2 25-minute sets with walking meditation in between. And it was great. And occasionally, I'd go to the temple really early and do 108 prostrations at, I don't know, quarter to five, quarter to six? I don't remember. It was really early. And then I'd do 2 sittings and I'd have breakfast with my teacher, Suka. And then I'd go off to law school. And I remember what it was like to walk into law school and how easily all of that sort of mindfulness I'd cultivated early in the morning would kind of drop away. Has anyone had this experience? I'd walk into law school, and the thing I remember is posters everywhere about stuff that was happening, and they're all kind of, it seems like they're shouting at you, and I felt like they were just kind of invading my brain, you know, and I'm trying to, okay, Ted, you know, keep it together here. You're in control of your brain, but this stuff is coming in. And all these people are rushing back and forth, and they look a little grim, and you've got classes, and you've got all these assignments. Excuse me. More assignments than anyone can really get done. And my mindful state just didn't have a chance. So continuous practice seems so far from what was happening that phrase just seemed to kind of point out my failings to me. So these are my true confessions here. I felt a little ashamed for not having a better practice and a little without hope sometimes. Because how could I ever practice continuously? My world, I think, at that time was divided into practice and non-practice. Practice was coming back to the breath and being mindful of my activity. And non-practice was grasping, monkey mind, ceding control of my mind to the things around it. And that seemed to happen a lot. I could practice pretty easily at the temple. I could practice pretty easily during my 5 minutes of meditation. I did pretty well riding my bike, but a lot of the rest of the time, studying, having dinner at home, it was just really hard. So I would always think, okay, I'm going to start now. It hasn't been working, but I'm going to start now, and I'm going to have continuous practice from this point on. And so I would sort of gather all of my energy and have this continuous attention, and after a pretty short time, that would be gone. So it's like, okay, I'm going to start now. And each time, it was a failure. I'm exaggerating a little bit to make my point, but not very much. So I came here in 1993, and at some point I learned where that phrase continuous practice came from. It's from Dogen. And Dogen, as many of you know, was the founder of the Japanese Soto Zen school, which we follow. Lee talked about Dogen last week. He's our guy. He was born 813 years ago. He was born in the year 1200. And he was a prolific writer. His writing is very challenging, and it's very wonderful. And he wrote a fascicle called Gyoji. There's Gyoji 1 and Gyoji 2. And these fascicles are about various Buddhist ancestors, and they tell us inspiring stories about their practice. And the first paragraph of Gyoji 1 is on your program here. And I'd like to go through that paragraph today with the hope that we can find something in here that will not lead to shame or defeat, and which actually might even help us to feel a little better about our practice. You think we can do it? So Gyoji literally means activity. But the thing I would like to emphasize is that this paragraph is about time. My problem with the phrase continuous practice, my despair at the fact that my own practice was so far from what I thought it should be, I think had to do with a misperception about time. I say misperception, but it wasn't really about the mind perceiving. It was deeper than that. It was in my bones. I had a misperception about time deep in my bones. So I'll just read this. This is the first paragraph of a much longer work. On the great road of Buddha ancestors, there is always unsurpassable practice, continuous and sustained. It is the circle of the way and is never cut off. Between aspiration, practice, enlightenment, and nirvana, there is not a moment's gap. Continuous practice is the circle of the way. This being so, continuous practice is unstained, not forced by you or others. The power of this continuous practice confirms you as well as others. It means your practice affects the entire earth and the entire sky in the 10 directions. Although not noticed by others or yourself, it is so. So I'd like to go through this line by line. It begins on the great road of Buddha ancestors. The great road. In using this metaphor of a road, I think Dogen here is acknowledging that there is a linear aspect to time. There's two ways that we might think of the way of the Buddha ancestors as a road, and both are linear. We might think of it as referring to the supposedly unbroken line of Buddhist teachers through which we trace our lineage back to the Buddha through India, China, and then Japan, and then here to the United States. We think of this as a continuous line of teachers from the past to the present, continuing into the future. We chant their names. We may imagine that none of them ever strayed from the path, ever, for a moment, and that their practice was continuous. They're the ideal. Of course, we may have doubts. There may have been a couple of losers in there. It seems like the odds favor it, doesn't it? Just saying. Or the road of the Buddha ancestors could refer to our own practice. It could be our individual practice or our practice together. We can think of it as a road because it has a starting point and it continues in time, and there are steps along the way. And this is what I'm going to call linear time, which is a phrase from Joan Halifax, who has also talked about continuous practice. The other kind of time is as a circle, and I'll talk about that shortly. But first, I wanted to provide some examples of linear time. And one is that Dogen himself uses examples of linear time in Gyoji 1. For example, he says, "Venerable Maha Kashyapa did not turn back or deviate from the 12 ascetic practices throughout his lifetime. The 12 ascetic practices included such things as having only one meal per day and never lying down to sleep, but instead to sleep sitting up." And here's another one. "Venerable Parshva, the 10th ancestor, did not lay himself down on his side to sleep throughout his lifetime." So, continuous practice, linear time. The second example of linear time is the one I gave you when I was at the Zen temple, and I saw time stretching out in front of me in a linear way, which led me to feel kind of this sense of despair. And I can add that this is the way I felt about law school, too. Law school was really hard. In fact, I'm grateful for law school because it drove me to Zen. I found law school really difficult, and I would think of how much time I had to go, like, wow, I've got 2.5 more years to go. How am I ever going to do this? It's stretching out before me. And somebody who was really helpful said, you know, gave me this very good advice, which we often hear but have a hard time taking to heart, which is don't think about the enormity of the task stretching out before you. Think of one day at a time. Think about what you have to do right now. And I was able to do this, and it went better. It went better. Another example of thinking of practice in a linear way is the formal steps we have in our tradition. You can complete the 4 introductory courses or classes up on the third floor, which many of you have done. You can take evening classes. You can do practice period. You can complete a retreat or a series of retreats. You can take vows and soa rakusu. Many of you are doing that right now. You can be ordained as a priest. You can become shuso. You receive Dharma transmission. With these steps, give us something to aspire to. And these are very helpful in our practice. But, of course, we all know there's a little danger there. You can get kind of attached to the steps. You can kind of think, oh, this is a preliminary step, so I'll just do this, and the real enlightenment comes later. And you think, well, this doesn't have to do with enlightenment. This is just practicing for enlightenment. But we know in Zen, it's right here, right now. This is the enlightenment. The step is the enlightenment, but I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit here. And the fourth example is soing the rakusu itself. Applying the linear way of looking at time, which we need to do, which is helpful. We think, okay, I've got till the end of August. I've got a lot of stitches here. I've got a lot of hours to put in. This is the progress I need to make. And so you're kind of cutting up time into these units. Of course, the opposite way of looking at this, the non-linear view of time, is forgetting all that after you've done the planning and just coming back to this stitch. This stitch right here matters. This is the whole universe. This is the entire step. This is it. I'm not practicing for something else. This is it right now. Right now. So, and that reflects Dogen's view of time. This is it right now. This thing. He says, "There is always unsurpassable practice, continuous and sustained." There is always unsurpassable practice, continuous and sustained. How can that be? Is he taking the linear view? Is he meaning that it's continuous and sustained only when we become enlightened and we're perfect and we never stray? I think we'd be kind of discouraging to think that. Because this is, as Tim said a couple of weeks ago, a practice of small steps. This is a practice of small steps and small increments and just kind of one thing at a time. Sometimes something dramatic may happen and you may feel transformed, but generally, no. This is small steps. This is like going out into the fog and your robe eventually gets wet, but you can't really say when that happened. There was not this dramatic moment when you got soaked through. It just happened as you continued to walk. No, there must be a different way that practice can be continuous, and there must be a different way of looking at time. And Dogen is about to tell us about that. It is the circle of the way, and it is never cut off. The circle of the way, circular time. And a comment by this, another translation of Dogen, Enlightenment Unfolds, Tanahashi, Kazuaki Tanahashi, says that Dogen accepts the linear process of seeking, but he also talks about the way as a circle. For him, each moment of practice encompasses enlightenment, and each moment of enlightenment encompasses practice. In other words, practice and enlightenment, process and goal, are inseparable. The circle of practice is complete even at the beginning. The circle of practice enlightenment is renewed moment after moment. And he continues, at the moment you begin taking a step, you have arrived, and you keep arriving each moment thereafter. In this view, you don't journey toward enlightenment, but you let enlightenment unfold. And this is what Thich Nhat Hanh means in his phrase, peace is every step. The step is the entire journey. So enlightenment, by definition, cannot happen in the future. There is no enlightenment in the future. It can only happen now. There is no enlightenment apart from this very moment. Continuous practice can only happen now. And if that's true, if continuous practice can only happen now, that challenges our conventional view, and I think it ends our despair. As I've said, the reason continuous practice is scary is that when we hear it, we think about how we have to do these things in the future and how hard that's going to be and how inevitably we're going to fail. But there is no future. There is only this moment. We can do the practice in this moment. We know we can. That possibility is always open to us. Sometimes we choose not to, but we can do it in this moment. It is the circle of the way, and it is never cut off. And it, again, is the great road of the Buddha ancestors. Without the linear view of time, it is always here. We cannot be separated from it. That this very moment is always here. But what if we're distracted by this moment? What if this is one of those no good moments? Does this moment count? Or is this moment somehow outside of Dogen's circle? I don't think so. How can these no good moments be part of Dogen's circle? Well, he says, between aspiration, practice, enlightenment, and nirvana, there is not a moment's gap. Continuous practice is the circle of the way. So we have aspiration. Aspiration is a rousing Bodhi mind. It is aspiring to do this practice. And then there are practice itself and enlightenment and nirvana, whatever we might think those things are. Between these things, there's not a moment's gap. Joan Halifax says that our very aspiration is awakening. No different than the practice of the precepts, no different than cooking in the kitchen, no different than the production of phenomena in the mind. Thinking? Everything is a vehicle of liberation, even those no good moments. There is no gap between aspiration and enlightenment. How can that be? Everything is the vehicle of liberation. If everything is the vehicle of our liberation, that must include our thoughts. That must include our delusion. The painting of the rice cake must be the rice cake. So Dogen here is challenging our idea of what practice is, of what moments matter to us. He's challenging our conventional view that sometimes we practice and sometimes we don't. because aspiration is about our small mind. Aspiration is a little mind wanting to be different. But there's no gap between wanting to be and being. Sometimes we're self-centered and our mind is grasping, but it's a mistake to say to ourselves that our grasping mind is just no good and that our only hope is to cut off that moment and become someone else and enter this new moment as a different person and do it right this time. It's the circle of the way, and it is never cut off. Katagiri said it this way: in each moment is the universe. These four things, aspiration, practice, enlightenment, and nirvana, go continuously in the orbit of a circle that is beginningless and endless. So this circular view of time, no gap between aspiration and enlightenment, what does this mean for our practice? It means that really, wherever we find ourselves is where we are, and we must embrace that, whatever it is, even those no good moments. And so there's this subtle thing that we do when we're meditating, or really it's something we don't do when we're meditating. And it's so easily misunderstood. So we need sort of a giant microscope here to look at how a thought might occur in meditation. So I'm going to talk for about 5 minutes about something that happens in about half a second. So say I'm sitting here, and my mind is very quiet. I'm in Sesshin, and I'm having these moments where there is no Ted. You know, I've become very quiet, and there are just things arising. There are sounds, there are physical sensations, they're coming and going, there's no comment upon them. My brain, my thought is not involved, there is no wanting, there's no fear of losing these things, there's no need to grasp them. It's perfect equanimity in the midst of flux. And there's that little mechanism that says, oh, I have to hang on to this, and that's gone. I'm not hanging on to anything. And then in comes a thought, say something like this: gee, Ted, you're in samadhi. This is pretty cool. And that, in the linear way of thinking, just kills the whole deal. This causes what Joan Halifax says is a split, where our behavior is not congruent with our ethics, she says. We've fallen into non-practice in the linear way of thinking. The split can continue and deepen. Ted, you're not supposed to think about being in samadhi. You've just blown it. Now you've got to start over. You've got to return to your practice. I am breathing in. I am breathing out. It's easy to think that something has gone terribly wrong here. As someone said to me once at Sonoma, one woohoo, and it's all gone. It's just all gone. So I say to myself, this is cool. And then it's like, no. You know, I'm like that Edvard Munch character. Yeah. No, I've lost it all. I've magnified the split about 1,000 times. I've said, oh, the universe is divided into two things. There's delusion, which just happened, and then there's non-delusion, which is the way I was before and the way I have to work at to get back to again. But that's a really dualistic way of looking at the universe. What if I fully and totally, without pause, accept that this is cool, is the way it is right now? What if I fully embrace that delusion and just let it be? Just let it be. What if I fully accept that my delusion is my enlightenment? If I don't judge myself or berate myself, but I truly just let it go, then this is cool happens, and then the next thing happens. And that's all there is. There's no trace. Imperfection, when left alone, is perfection. Leave it alone. I'm perfect in my imperfection. Delusion, grasping, and false views are only delusion, grasping, and false views if you hang on to them. And Joan Halifax said, what we ask for here at Upaya, that's their center, is congruency. To notice the split in our behaviors and then not to split from the split. Okay, the part about noticing may be extra, but I love that part about do not split from the split. When you lose your way, you are perfect Buddha losing your way. And please, please be perfect Buddha losing your way. Because when you do that, you cannot possibly be lost. And you can be grateful for your delusion. Between aspiration, practice, enlightenment, and nirvana, there is not a moment's gap. This is so subtle, and it's so easy to get it wrong. If our delusions are enlightenment, why not just continue to be deluded? Why not just let your thoughts run? That's not what we're talking about. We're not talking about indulging your thinking mind. There's a universe of difference between a thought coming in and letting it be, and a thought coming in and enhancing it with another thought. A world, a universe of difference there. This being so, continuous practice is unstained, not forced by you or others. Continuous practice is unstained. Joan Halifax says, again, I'm quoting her a lot, but she writes this stuff really well. It is unstained by any contrivances, by thinking, by naming, categorizing, or wishing. We're not bringing in that stuff. Not forced by you or others. You simply cannot do Zen practice in linear time. You cannot somehow get rid of this moment and become someone else and enter into the next moment having destroyed that bad moment. You simply cannot force this. And Joan Halifax again says, and this is beautiful, and if you don't remember anything else from this talk, please remember this. We cannot be forced into this deep experience. We only arrive there by relaxing into what Dogen calls the miracle of the moment. Relaxing into it. Relaxing into it. Like the royal ease bodhisattva. So I recently went to the Art Institute with Laura. We took the youth group there. And they have a couple of Kuan Yin statues from China, which are made of wood. And they're in that royal ease position with their knee up. And the body is just so relaxed. The whole body is just so relaxed. That should be our ideal. Our mind should be like that body is. You know, we should aspire to have no bones at all. Just be totally relaxed. No bones in our mind. The power of this continuous practice confirms you as well as others. The more you give yourself to this practice, the more you give yourself to the community, the more confirming it is for both you and the community. You're confirming the great road of the Buddha ancestors. It means your practice affects the entire earth and the entire sky in the 10 directions. Because this is a healing practice. With your innocent attention, you can save the entire world. I'm not going to explain how this is true. I don't think I can. Through non-linear zazen, you can save the entire world. Through letting this stitch be just this stitch. For letting this delusion be, just letting it be, which means not encouraging it and not fighting it. And so you're not hanging on to it. And so there is no trace. Although not noticed by others or yourself, it is so. There's no one to notice. So that's the paragraph. We've gone through it. And I think it's pretty good news. Continuous practice. In order to do this practice effectively, you do not have to be perfect moment after moment after moment without a break into the future. In order to do this practice effectively, you only have to be aware enough to know when you stray into that self-centered view, and you have to be one with the straying. Be right there. Be who you are. Ask, what is it now? Be perfect in your imperfection. This is a practice for human beings, not gods, not angels. Just come back when you stray. That is continuous practice in the nonlinear sense. That is the circle of the way. There's no existing me over here and perfect me over here. If I can be existing me, then I'm perfect me. Continuous practice. Continuous, perfect, imperfect me. Which is not me, but that's another talk. And so this perfect, imperfect practice may at some point ripen into continuous practice in the linear sense. But you know what? We don't have to worry about that. So let's not. And this practice, what does it do? It does something profound. It affects the entire earth and the entire sky in the 10 directions. And I've talked to people, I've talked about this before, I've talked to people who arrive at Zen Center and they get to know the place a little bit, and they see some of the long-term practitioners here, and they come to a sitting and they sense this kind of profound quiet in the Zendo. It happens a lot of the time. And they get to know people and they see that they carry that profound quiet with them out of the Zendo and out into the world. And they don't see them stray. They probably stray, but they don't see it. They don't see it here. And I've heard people say upon seeing that, that I'm so far from that. You know, I could never do that. And that's how it was for me in the beginning. As Tim said, I think it was 2 weeks ago, he talks to a lot of people about their practice, and everyone seems to think that their mind is busier and crazier than everyone else's mind. And I think that's true. And sometimes people leave because of that. And I think that's tragic. I can remember saying that to myself years ago. I can remember saying, I cannot become a Buddha in this lifetime. It's just not going to happen. It just can't happen because look what I have to work with here. It's not going to happen. And you know who was saying that? Who was saying I can't be Buddha in this lifetime? That was Buddha. So you have to believe me. I know this is true from my own experience, and the experience of people I've talked to and the journeys that I've been privileged to share with people. This practice is about healing. And I hesitate to say that out loud because I don't want to be misunderstood. I don't mean that there's something wrong with us and that's why we're Buddhists. It's not that at all. But we all need healing sometimes. Everyone, Buddhist or not. And the world needs healing. The earth needs healing. The plants on the earth, the creatures on the earth, they all need healing. And I think of my own wound. You know, we have wounds. And how wounded I was back when I thought I couldn't be a Buddha in this lifetime. And you might not think that I would be wounded. I've been really lucky in my life, I think. I was born into a really caring and loving family, and I have a lot of confidence, and I have a lot of security, and yet I've had this great wound. And I think the wound may be actually because I was so fortunate. It could be because I was born with a really good brain, and my oldest brother was not. He suffered a brain injury at birth, and it seemed like I could do anything I wanted in this world, that it was all open to me. And he couldn't even talk. My brother couldn't even talk. And it seems like sometimes if we don't have wounds, we somehow create them. You know, we have a sort of happiness preventing mechanism, which is really, really strong. But that wound, I think, that I had has been closed. You know, maybe not fully, not completely, not for all time, but oh my God, what a change. It's like a friend now, this wound. It's like it's here with me. It's here with me constantly, you know? And it somehow gives me strength. And it's not just me. You know, I see so many people who come here and they acquire, after a while, they acquire this beautiful glow. I say acquire. They don't really acquire. It was there all the time. That glow was there all the time. And they come here and they start this practice, and something allows that to be uncovered. You know, not always, but sometimes, you know, people, they find a way to relax into the beauty of the moment, and there is nothing more beautiful than that. And there's nothing we want more than that. And you, I've got to tell you that you can do this thing. You may have doubts. You may think that you cannot be Buddha in this lifetime. It is not true. It is not true. You can do this thing. I promise you, you can do this thing. You can become quiet and you can go so deep. And when you're ready, you can be in the presence of this thing, whatever it is. Maybe it's guilt or shame or fear. It's usually fear. And you can bring it up into the light of day, and it can be your friend. And the energy of that will astound you. Because do you know how much energy you use to keep it down there? Mm-hmm. Can you imagine if you were freed with that energy? This thing were with you all the time. So, sometimes we talk about converting suffering into joy, and I like that. I keep, you know, kind of thinking about that, but really it's beyond that. It's really beyond suffering and joy. It's this vivid, perfect, imperfect life. And it's nothing special. That's our practice. It's nothing special. So continuous practice. You come back now. When you have the thought of who you are and who you want to be, when you see that split, just come back to now. Okay, that was it. Just come back to now. That's all. That's all you have to do. And of course, I've reverted to linear time here to tell you, you know, what might happen in the future if you do this stuff. And I'm okay with that. Because I want you here. I want you to know the power of this practice. I want you here. Here at Zen Center, or wherever you are, I want you to be here. Right here, right now. Wherever you are. That's what I want. Because this is the road of the Buddha ancestors. This is the vision. Because all of this really matters. Because we all have the capacity to be Buddha in this lifetime. And we all are already Buddha right now. So believe me, and you will not be alone. Hand in hand, may we realize the awakened way together. That's the ideal. That's the ideal, and that's the reality. But it has to be all of us. It has to be all of us. So believe me, this is you, Buddha in this lifetime. It has to be all of us. So, thanks for listening. And I'd be happy to take questions or comments.
I found this reassuring because a combination of the wisdom that comes with age, I think, and what I do and what I teach people to do and all of those things coming together have really made my practice much less of that sense of linear chore kind of thing. It's just mm-hmm. like, and there's kind of three words that are sort of key. One is permission, one is simplicity, and one is surrender.
Mm-hmm.
And surrender is just do it, trust, surrender to the process. Just do it
mm-hmm.
and trust.
Mm-hmm.
Simplicity is don't, and this is kind of a theme for so many things, don't make it harder than it needs to be.
Mm-hmm.
and permission is, for me, giving myself permission to know that when I'm in that kind of samadhi state or in something, you know, approximating that, and I go to that woohoo where I go to, you know, I slip out, mm-hmm. that I have permission to go right back into it. I don't have to start over.
Uh-huh.
Okay. But you have to, but we have to give ourselves permission because we think that we have to start, we have to build it from the ground
yeah.
up every single
yeah.
time.
Yeah. And where does that permission come from? It comes from great kindness,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Real kindness.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. In that moment, you need that. All that kindness
yeah.
that you have for everyone, you know, comes to yourself right now.
Yeah.
And that's the best thing you can do for anyone else. Bring that kindness to that moment.
And those three things can make such a difference in your practice.
Yeah. Thank you.
Ted?
Yes?
I was taking my Royal Ease on the side of the highway
last
weekend and was jailed for it. So I had to go to the restroom.
I see.
Was in bumper to bumper traffic.
Oh, my.
Well, You can't urinate publicly, let me tell you.
Thanks, we've gotten a helpful tip today.
But it was an emergency.
Yeah.
There was no separation between me and having to go pee.
I see. Uh-huh.
And, gosh, if I could apologize to those people one by one, having to watch the back of me as I pee on the side of the highway,
mm-hmm.
I would. But, it seems like I was kind of the victim for having been jailed like a criminal for such an honest act.
Yeah. I think in a lot of places that wouldn't have happened. But I'm sorry you had a rough week.
Yeah. You look good in pinstripes.
Orange.
Wow. Well, thank you.
Watch out.
So that raises a question. Of course, there's the world of emptiness. The absolute world. But we all live in a conceptual world.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's say you're a lawyer, mm-hmm. and you talked about no mistakes, whatever, no errors, it's all part of the cycle, etc. And so you don't defend a client well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, so would you say a few words about how we take that teaching
mm-hmm.
and apply it in the
mm-hmm.
activities?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it would be a mistake to say that anything about what I'm saying means that we can kind of have a lax attitude toward the conventional world and the things that need to be done here. Let's not get stuck in linear time, so let's not worry about stuff. When we had storm damage here last week, we could always, say, well, we're too much in the moment to do that planning. Well, of course you have to do that planning. And that's really, really important. And that is part of this practice I'm talking about. That's practice too. I mean, using your thinking mind to plan this kind of stuff is part of this practice. And it's very, very important. And in fact, that's what this training always points us back to, is being really effective in the world. The things we do here, whether it's sweeping the floor or writing a talk or writing a book or whatever it is, we try to do that just as well as we possibly can. So, thanks, Guy. Yeah, right action. Right action.
I just have a follow-up. What are we supposed to do?
Well, it was a bit of a question. So we have these moments where there is no separation between I can't think of how to express exactly what I mean when the thoughts arise and you don't split the split, but maybe the outward expression of just being there is maybe not socially acceptable or outside of the norm. And you, as an individual, sometimes don't get to choose that because of the society we live in. Those are rules outside
mm-hmm.
of you,
mm-hmm.
that are there to protect people and so on. I particularly only have the choice not to demean myself or feel wrong because I don't agree with these rules. Because very much there was no other choice.
In your question, what are you supposed to do?
Yeah, I'm thinking, like, I'm on the highway, I gotta go. What's the rule?
The one recommendation that he gave me was that, should have been further than 10 feet off the highway.
Okay.
Keep it in the mason jar. Plan ahead.
All right. Anything else? Yes?
Would it even be cheaper to shampoo your car having pee in it than to pay for a wash?
It would. There you go.
I can tell you.
Here's another idea.
Okay.
I would like to say, I've been using affirmations that I am perfectly imperfect.
Mm-hmm.
And your description of this was really helpful to me. My definition of it was A, B, and all else, but I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Well, thanks, everyone. I think we have some announcements now.